When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Everyday Warrior Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cirelli. We've got a good one today. Anthony Michael Hall. And, you know, just to say I grew up on your films is an understatement. I called my sister. I graduated high school in 96. Now we're dating ourselves, man. It was 87. And I'm like, hey, so I'm interviewing Anthony Michael Hall tomorrow. And she's like, oh, my God. It's like... So, guys, you know, for the younger generation... these are not classic films. Somebody said that the other day, and I'm like, these aren't classics yet. He was part of the, you know, two most iconic films of the 80s. And, you know, 16 Candles and The Breakfast Club, also Weird Science. Dude, you've had an amazing career, no signs of slowing down. You just released one, Air Force One Down. You've got Roswell Delirium that's shown in film festivals now. You just signed on for the third season of Reacher. When are you going to stop, dude?
First of all, thanks for what you said, Mike. It's an honor to be with you today, sir. No, I appreciate it, man. I think I just, you know, to as a prerequisite to this business, you got to have a hard head. You know, it's like anything. You got to have full commitment. You know, I think the parallels with the military or sports are all right there. You really just have to have a tough skin, and you got to be teachable. You got to learn and adapt and grow. And it's always been my instinct, even since I was a kid, Mike. I had kind of that self-talk that told me, you know what, I'm going to keep doing this till I'm an old man, and no one's going to take this away from me. And I just thank God for my blessings, and I try to work hard. And you know, I did a picture with Danny Trejo about 10 years ago and Mickey Rourke. It was called Dead in Tombstone. And Danny said something great to me before we were about to shoot a scene, Mike. He goes, he said, Mike, I'm like a mechanic. I go where the work is, you know, and that really resonated with me. So I feel the same. You know, nothing's promised. I think a lot of times actors maybe create this sense that this is all on course and this has all been smooth and easy. But, you know, there are no promises made in the entertainment industry. So I'm grateful. I thank God for, you know, what I've had.
Dude, from an outsider, it seems like the entertainment industry is it's cutthroat. And... they will, and even somebody who was part of the Brat Pack, and I know when it was the New York, I'm trying to think of the periodical or the magazine that released it. I know that wasn't meant to be a testament, but for guys, you know, the Rat Pack of the 50s.
Right.
I mean, you're in history, man. But it seems like Hollywood will dispense people like that the second there's no more utility, I guess, to them.
It's a great point you make, Mike. Absolutely. And that's why you have to have a burning desire. You know, it's very important to have passion and to have drive and to pursue excellence. Honestly, that's been my goal. Even with that prerequisite of not knowing what was going to happen or having no guarantees. You know, when that article was written, you were spot on. I think that was exactly the name of the magazine, which New York Magazine. And it was just a silly thing. It was a way to sort of encapsulate that group of us at that time, but I never took it seriously, and it never really bothered me. I always thought the Rat Pack was a lot cooler anyway.
No, the Rat Pack was my generation. No, we loved it. And, you know, eventually, man, and from what I've read, and I want to hear your, you know, you felt, from what I've read, you felt like you were getting typecasted into this genre, and you specifically made a choice to seek different roles to move outside of, you know, the teenage actor. First off, Johnny B. Goode is one of the, like, I've got to say, that is my favorite of all. War Machine was pretty good because you guys just, you ripped on the military in a way that was just like, yep, yeah, that's pretty much how it is. But you passed up on certain roles, like Ferris Bueller, from what I read. At what point did that dawn on you, hey, I've got to do something different, or I'm just going to be stuck in this sort of this genre for the rest of my life?
Right. Well, just if I can, just to widen out a little bit. I mean, first of all, John Hughes, I wouldn't be sitting here with you, Mike, if it wasn't for John Hughes. He really was such a great guy. He was such a great artist. Back in 2010, as you know, I think that the Oscars honored him and they paid tribute to John's work and legacy. But I wouldn't be sitting here before you, Mike, without him. Yeah, I mean, it was a conscious effort. After I did the three films with John, I wanted to kind of break away. And that's when I did this picture in 85 called Out of Bounds. And it was a crazy year for me, I'll be honest. I was doing Saturday Night Live. I'm 17 years old. I went to L.A. with my father, who was my manager at the time, God rest his soul. And I had a meeting with the head of Columbia Studios and Pictures. And I was starring in this film, Out of Bounds. And so that was the first, to your question, Mike, first way that I addressed that. I wanted to kind of break out and do different things. And I didn't want to be pigeonholed. And I mean, the truth is, I wasn't in high school much anyway. I was on the set with John Hughes. Yeah. I was working, you know. And nothing against the nerdy types, but I really wasn't that great a student, to be honest with you. I got my GED, and then I think I had a combined maybe 900 on my SAT. So I was I wasn't heading for for the Ivy League, as it were. But, you know, it was a conscious effort to go in a different direction and play and do different things. And at that time, I partnered with a guy named Richard Tuggle. He was the writer-director. He had done some pictures with Clint Eastwood, and we made Out of Bounds for Columbia. And it was in that crazy season. You know, I think of that Sinatra song. You know, when I was 17, it was a very good year. It was. I was really fortunate. And I was working for Mr. Lorne Michaels at NBC. And I was starring in a picture for Columbia. And I was taking steps to individuate, I guess, and to kind of move in a different direction as an actor and kind of show some different stuff. So, yeah, that was it.
Well, I've got to ask about your days at Saturday Night Live, because, again, for the listeners, I don't know, you may still hold the title youngest SNL staffer or actor. What was that experience like at 17?
Well, I tell you, I think I do hold that record, you know, but to give it context and fairness, all due respect to that legacy and institution that we all love as SNL, but it was probably one of the worst seasons in the history of the 50 years of the show. It was incredible. You know, I'll tell you what it's like, Mike. It's like rock and roll, theater, stand-up comedy. It's everything rolled into one. And at the same time, you're just like the military. You never lose sight of that. You're just got to play your position, know your role, and contribute, you know. And you're part of a couple hundred people that are putting on this show. And it's amazing. I'll tell you what, Mike. You come in on a Monday, you start writing, you start partnering up. You know, it's, you know, that show 30 Rock was loosely based on the life, you know, the scenes, yes, you know, behind the scenes at SNL. But it was really an incredible job. You know, you come in on a Monday, you start writing Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Wednesday is sort of the demarcation line where we have to turn in our sketches. And this was back in the day, so we didn't have laptops and computers. They had all these nice assistants that would type up our sketches. And then we do a read-through about 4 p.m. on a Wednesday, Mike. And from that, Lawrence starts deciding the show. So he invites the cast and the key department heads on our crew. And we're up in 30 Rock in that floor that we had. And we would do a read-through of all the sketches. And basically, whatever was garnering the most laughs, whatever made Lauren laugh in the group, you know, so it's incredible. So then the second half of the week kicks in, which is amazing. We start rehearsing Thursday morning, Mike. We come in 10 a.m. You know, it's not banker's hours. We got a little bit of a leeway there. And we start rehearsing the show. And I'm telling you, it's around the clock, man. We're there till 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Friday, same thing, Mike. You got to report for duty at 10 or 11 a.m. We're rehearsing around the clock into the late hours of the evening. Saturday, same thing. Full day rehearsal. And then we do the show twice. They do it twice. They bring in a live audience at 7, right? And they're standing in the hallway where they often shoot a lot of the sketches. They bring that audience in. We do the show live, and there's about an hour, hour and a half in between. They shuffle that audience out. They bring in the final live audience, and we do it again. So as you can see, it's like a 6-day-a-week job. It's an amazing effort, you know. So I have nothing but respect for all the men and women that have been a part of that show. And it's got such a rich history. There's so many great people.
You know, so was that one of your hardest working years ever. I didn't know the schedule was like that.
I think so. You know, and at the same time, I had a unique deal that I was able to cut with Lauren at the time because I was doing Out of Bounds. So I didn't do the complete season. You know, I brought Downey to Lauren's attention, and Downey was doing the whole season and the rest of our cast. And I think I did, let's say if we did 18 or 20 episodes, I think I did 13 or 14. So it was kind of an abbreviated schedule. But again, this is like, you know, the equivalent of my senior year in high school. I was hitting the pavement. Yeah, man, I was putting in the work.
I think you put most seniors to shame. I've got to ask, man, for somebody who enters Hollywood so young, and I'm sure you've got very few regrets because you've lived a fulfilling and impactful life, but do you have any, you know, regrets from missing out on like the high school experience or anything? Or did you feel like part of your youth was, I hate to use the word robbed.
Right.
It's what,
you know, I never chose, that's a good question, Mike. I never chose to operate from that perspective. I've always felt blessed and grateful. And as I said, I really wasn't a bookworm. So I was grateful to be out of school and working. I never felt that, you know, I think that I have felt at times in my life, a sense that I was certainly committed and dedicated to my craft and to my work and to contributing, you know, and being impactful, as you said. So I looked at it like that. I never looked at it through another negative lens. But with that said, I want to acknowledge all the, you know, there have been many young actors that sadly didn't make it through, you know. Yeah. Dana Plato, I mean, a young guy, Gary Coleman. I mean, people that I watched as a kid, you know. There have been many, and it's always a tragic occurrence. But again, I had that foundation, which we haven't spoken of yet. You know, I was raised by a very strong-willed Italian-Irish Catholic mother, and she gave me that foundation of my faith, family, and both of my parents. They really instilled that work ethic. Like, look, you got to show up, do the work, be approachable, be accessible. So to your earlier question, like if I had any regrets, I think I wish I would have sort of seen the bigger picture earlier. But then again, you know, I was a kid at the time, so I factor all that in, you know. But I'm grateful for the run, you know, I really am.
Hey, so you definitely credit your mom with the foundation of...
Absolutely, yeah.
Your mom was a singer, writer, correct?
She was. She was a singer, and she was a single mom. You know, my father, Larry Hall, they divorced when I was a baby.
Yeah.
And my mother moved out west from Boston. She was a Northeastern girl. She was raised in New York, in Boston, excuse me, one of 13 kids. And by the time, let's say she's 20 and I'm, you know, I was just born, we moved out west to California. And she, you know, was pursuing her career here in the early 70s. And then we wound up moving back to New York when I'm about 4 or 5. And she raised me as a single mom, literally singing for our supper. She was a jazz and R&B singer. And so I have great respect for my mother. And at the same time, when my father came along, he was great. My stepfather adopted me when I was 12. And then they had my sister, Mary, who's thriving. She's a great artist and a businesswoman. So I think that foundation, again, faith and having a strong-willed mother and father, and that taught me the right way, you know, and really, you know, with an accent on having respect and respect for the work too, you know, and that nothing is promised. You have to just keep, you know, being diligent and continue to show up, as it were. You know?
Yeah. I think a lot of people are losing sight of that. As the saying goes, rent is due every day. I don't care who you are, what you've done before.
Yes, sir.
Hey, back on one comment, you know, you bring up the Gary Colemans, and this may have been sort of influential in your decision. Do you think it was once you get typecasted, I mean, no, that nobody can see Gary Coleman other than what the role he played for so many years was? Is it just become so difficult to break? And do you think that's what kills a lot of actors? When you've got a good thing going, you know, the hands were two in the bush. I can understand continuing to get that paycheck. But do you think that holds true, that once you're typecasted, it really impacts the remainder of your career?
I think it certainly can for some kids and young actors, you know, be it male or female. And I think at the same time, if they get too attached to that image of what they've done, and all I can do is speak for myself. And I know that even for myself, things that worked for me as a child actor, you know, kind of the natural God-given gift I had, I guess, with comedy and being funny, suddenly that stuff didn't apply in my early 20s. And so I can speak from my own experience that I really had to reinvest and say to myself, look, do I really want to do this for the rest of my life? Number one. Number two, how do I make myself better? How do I improve? How do I self-improve? So then I went about that process. And again, I think it's been over the decades. I'm 56 years old now, and I started out when I was 8 years old. I've had a 49-year career, or whatever that is, 48. And I'm just grateful. But for me, because of my own constitution, I think I was always able to reinvest in myself and say to myself, you know what, I'm going to keep going and I'm not going to be pigeonholed or I'm not going to. So I think that's really what gave birth to the life of an actor, because you have to be a man of a thousand faces in a way. You have to be willing to accept the roles and go for things that aren't necessarily something maybe you've done, or also learn humility and play a smaller role, let's say in a bigger project. And so I think all these things over time, Mike, they distill in you, you know, a good work ethic, and you realize, look, it's not just about you. You got to contribute to the team. You got to make the team.
Yeah. One of the three most powerful words, it's not about you, or four. It's not about you. No film always rests on the shoulders of one person. It's the supporting cast and everyone that leads to that victory. And you've been part of many of those teams. I've got to ask the generic question. You probably get asked this. If there's one film where, let's just say, you had the most fun, what was that film?
Well, I think the three John Hughes films kind of stand alone because of the relationship I had with him, Mike. He was like a big older brother, you know. We were just simpatico, you know. So I was 15 at the time. John Hughes was 35 when we started working together. So either we were both 15, or I was 35 at 15. We just had a great working relationship. So those kind of stand alone. But over the years, you know, you mentioned War Machine. That's a picture I'm really proud of. I was really honored to be a part of that film and to work alongside Mr. Pitt. He's a great guy. And I'm happy to say that he's everything people think he is. He's a stand-up guy, you know, from Missouri. He's a good man, great producer. I really learned a lot watching him. So that was a great experience for me. I kind of went a little bit method, to be very honest with you, Mike. And it was out of full deference and respect to all the military and my family. You know, my grandfather served in World War II. I had an uncle in the Korean War, an uncle in Vietnam. So it meant a lot to me to be a part of that project, you know, and it was based on a book called The Operators that Brad's company, Plan B, had optioned, and they gave it to an Australian director named David Michaud, who's an excellent filmmaker. And he adapted that book and it became War Machine. You know, in the picture, Brad is essentially playing General McChrystal and I'm playing General Flynn, you know, and yes. without picking sides here or getting into politics, you know, it was a high honor for me. It meant the world to me. And so I made a choice as an actor to kind of disappear a little bit. I didn't really want people to meet me. I wanted them to meet the general. And the way I looked at it is that there were two generals in that film. And, you know, honest to God, I was very respectful of Brad throughout the project. And in the morning, just, again, out of deference and service, I would offer him, can I get you a cup of coffee, sir? Can I get you the paper, anything you need, you know? So I really was committed when I made that film, and I was very proud of that movie. Sadly, when it came out, it got a little bit overlooked, I feel, because unfortunately, yeah. Mr. Pitt was going through his divorce with Angelina, I guess. And so sadly, you know, he wasn't able to promote it as much as I think maybe he would have wanted to. But nonetheless, that stands out. Another one I did was 61 with Billy Crystal back in the early 2000s. He was a great guy to work for, Mike. What a wonderful guy. And talk about fully committed. I mean, he would be doing stand-up for all the extras. We'd be shooting at Tiger Stadium or here in L.A. at the Coliseum. You know, it's just a great guy, you know, and really understood the idea and the value of team and was a lot of fun to work with. And I played Whitey Ford in that. That was about the race in 1961 for the home run, record, you know, between Maris and Mantle. They were trying to chase Babe Ruth's record. So that was a great picture that stood out to me. You know, goofy stuff over the years, too. Like I did Freddie Got Fingered, which with Tom Green years ago, that comedy, which I think won the Razzie that year from Harvard, the worst movie of whatever year that was. So I think certain films stand out for different things. You know, sometimes it's working with great actors and having fun with other actors. And sometimes it's the technical aspects of working with great directors. Like I did The Dark Knight with Chris Nolan. That was a great experience. Yes. An honor to work with him. You know,
yeah.
Tim Burton years ago. So a lot of people have been great to work with. Yeah.
You know, no one's going to doubt your love for acting. But you've moved also into the production side with Manhattan Films. Do you foresee that as a future? I mean, do you love backing other people's projects, whether you appear in the film or not? What led to that desire?
Yeah, you know, it goes back to John Hughes. I think even as a young man in my teens, all those years ago, Mike, I was so inspired by John. And I remember thinking, you know what? I want to get to that point one day. I want to be a writer director. I would love to have a company. And that's what I'm building toward. I'm taking, you know, baby steps, but I'm building towards that. My company, Manhattan Films, as you mentioned, thank you. Has produced a couple films in the last 3 years. One was called The Class, which was sort of a modern-day spin on The Breakfast Club. It wasn't a remake, but very proud of that picture. It was a writer-director named Nick Salozzi out of Chicago that wrote that film and directed it, and I'm very proud of that one. So the second one you mentioned, Roswell Delirium, thank you for that, Mike, is an independent film. again, where I partnered with a writer-director who I felt had vision, had written a really good script, and I played a part in it, but I also produced the film. And I have a partner now named Ben Ray, who's out of Utah, and we're working on financing the company and capitalizing it, so we want to do more. And I have something that's near and dear to my heart, a project that I wrote that I want to make and act in. So, you know, heroes of mine growing up were guys like Eastwood, I mean, Scorsese, great directors. So I've always had my eye on that. And again, with respect to John, I would love to direct some comedies. It would be great just to step back and kind of maybe do what he did for me with some kids and do something for a younger generation in terms of comedy. It would be great.
Let me ask you this, because we recently I partnered with the guy who did the Blair Witch Project, Daniel Myrick, on the documentary side, and we did five red carpet screeners. We're in a few theaters and select theaters now.
Awesome.
Every producer's rep we talk to says the industry has just been totally disrupted post-COVID, that everything is different. What's your perspective on the future of cinema production with all these streaming platforms, and how has the game changed in your eyes? Because
that's a great question. Yeah. Right. Congrats on your project, by the way, Mike. That's awesome.
Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. What I would say is I think the streamers have certainly made their, you know, have a huge imprint and have changed the business. I think growing up, it was like we had cable, right? And now we went from that to apps and streamers. I think I've had the good pleasure of working for Netflix and also now Amazon. I was on Bosch Legacy season 2, yes, and I just wrapped season 3 of Reacher. I got to say, I love working with the streamers. I mean, they give you a lot of freedom. But in terms of how the industry has changed, I think the distribution models have changed. So when we were growing up, it was like appointment television. There was 4 networks, or you had 50 channels of cable, and you knew what you were going to watch. You had to sit your butt down or DVR it, right? The world's changed, you know? So, and I think in terms of thinking macro, it's important to consider that, because we're in a new century. We're only 24 years into a new century. So I think you have to go with the flow. You have to be adaptive. I think people's tastes have changed. I think their attention spans have shortened, quite honestly. And I think a lot of that has to do with social media, but I think there's a lot of good to be garnered from that, just like there's a lot of negative from the internet or social too. So I think you kind of take the good with the bad and you incorporate it, but I think it certainly is a new time in the industry where things are changing and morphing. And you're right, it was very much affected by COVID and also the actor strike.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, so I think it's important to be adaptive and to go with the flow. Certainly there are less movies made these days than there are television shows. But I also think because you're fighting with people's attention spans, I mean, it's challenging, you know, because a lot of people, this younger generation, they love TikTok or whatever, and you're getting entertainment in 20-second bites, you know? So it's a very interesting time for all these reasons.
You know, I know a lot of people say that theaters are dying, and I'm sure you're part of the old breed, that it just, there's no experience like going to a theater,
yeah,
from the popcorn to the Coke,
right?
And watching it on the big screen. What do you say?
I agree with you. I still love that. I still love that. And I think, look, cameras, it's interesting how it's affected the industry technologically. Like cameras have gotten lighter, lights are smaller. You know, there's a certain mobility that has come with the progression in technology, which is interesting. But you're absolutely right. Nothing replaces the feeling of taking your lady to go to a movie. Or, you know, I've just become a parent, so we've taken our kid to the movies. I have a 1-year-old son. And thanks, man. And we put the little noise-canceling headphones on him. But I think nothing will replace that experience. And, I I'm a diehard in that regard, where I respect that and I love that experience. But, you know, it's interesting. Years ago, I read an article with Orson Welles, and it kind of doesn't apply anymore. You know, he said, you know, when you go to a movie, you're sitting, it's like a temple-like experience or church. You know, you're sitting in the dark with a bunch of strangers and you're kind of looking up at the screen. And his point at the time was, when people had televisions, you know, it's like kind of in the living room in your corner. Well, that's changed now, right? Everybody has home screens and,
yes,
and home theaters. And so I think it's very interesting too. I think that hopefully there's room for both. You know, I don't think that experience should ever go away. I think it's iconic, and I think it's one of the great gifts that our country has given to the world, you know, the movie going experience and movies itself. I love that myself, but at the same time, you know, it's hard to, you can't stop progress, as it were. And I think a lot of these streamers and what technology has done in terms of people having home theaters has changed the things, you know, it's changed the course of viewing for people. Yeah.
It's still not the same to me, man.
I'm with you, man. I'm with you.
There's, yeah. So I've got to ask, again, you've had a long run. That run isn't over. You've been exposed to so much, involved with over 50 films. What have you learned along the way from a sort of self-leadership standpoint that our viewers can take away a few nuggets and say, hey, yeah, I may not be in entertainment, but that still very much applies to what I do.
I appreciate that. Let me think about that for a second. Yeah. You know, it's never been lost on me. For example, Mike, when I drive onto a studio lot, I'm just blown away. I'm so grateful to God that I've had a career in this business and had a creative life. So that idea of working in teams, I think, is really important and valuable, and learning, just like you do in life. But whether you're in corporate or in the military or in sports, these ideas really apply. You know, the idea there's no I in team, you got to get it done. You do have a mission. You come to work with, you know, on Reacher, I just shot this series for a year. We were doing it because of the strike and the hiatus we had. We had to shoot for over the course of a year. We're talking about 300 people on that crew, Mike. It's a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
So again, knowing your role, being prepared, you know, contributing. But then at the same time, I think the importance of experientially to enjoy it, to enjoy the work, to enjoy the people you're with, to not take yourself so seriously, but to take your work seriously. That idea, I think, is really a good one that I think we get from people in life, you know, along the way. And I think that that's important. And as a kid with success in my teens and my 20s, sometimes, you know, you think it's you, you know, and you have to sort of unlearn that shit, you know, and realize that it's not about you. And so I think that sense of gratitude and appreciation for the craft, for working in teams, and ultimately, you know, hopefully contributing something that people can enjoy. You know, I think that that's really, it's a real gift, and it's never been lost on me. You know, project to project, I try to implement that and work with that awareness, you know. And I try to enjoy myself more and more, even now as it's in a different stage of my career, even more so. Yeah.
With all the wisdom that you now have that you did not have in your which is, that's life, 20s. I mean, that's awesome. You know, we shared a few of the things that are recent. Air Force One down, finished up, you know, filming Reacher third season, which has been a phenomenal success. Roswell, Delirium. Are there any passion projects that you're working on now that you can share with us, or are they closed close tight?
I do. Yeah, I have one that I wrote that I intend to direct, and that's what we're working on putting the money together for now. And this is the one I mentioned earlier, Mike, and it's called The Lost Shield. And I partnered with a guy named Chris Diente, who was a New York City cop. We had met through a mutual friend about 15 years ago, and I optioned a script that he had written. It was actually his original. And then I went about the process of rewriting it, and it's been my baby that I've been nurturing and working on. You know, it's interesting. As an actor, I never felt for many years that I understood stories. So quietly under the radar, I've been really investing in that, learning as a writer, trying to develop myself. And from the knowledge that I gained, I put it into rewriting this project that I told you about. And it's something that I would start and direct, but it's also an ensemble. So I've tried to apply myself in that regard and get that script as ready as I can make it. And it's in a great place now. I feel really good about it. So that's the one. It's called The Lost Shield. And it's a cop story about a cop that kind of goes rogue in a way. And it opens in New York, and then it winds up going to New Orleans. And I did a major rewrite on it a couple of years back, and I'm very proud of where it's at now. But, you know, something I learned from Robert Downey Sr., Downey's father, he said, writing is rewriting. You know, so the truth is, you can look at something and go, oh, this is good. But when you have to be open to change, you know, and I think that's important, too. But that's the project that I really do want to get made. And then I have another one that I wrote, which is called The Liberty Hotel, which is really interesting. It's something that I would not act in, but it's just an original idea that I had that's set in New England. And it's a story of two women. It's a little too in-depth to get into now, but it's a very interesting project. Also, there's a couple things that I've written and that I want to direct. And at the same time, I want to grow the company in a smart way. So that's my goal looking ahead.
Exciting. Exciting. Hey, one last thing I want to touch on, and we all know relationships matter. You know, we've seen, again, those outside of Hollywood, some relationships that last from your days in the 80s that are still there. I know you're close with Robert Downey Jr., your godfather to his son. I'm sure some other relationships have gone to the wayside. When you mix fame with that industry, is it difficult to manage relationships sometimes, or what has been sort of also your key elements to how you treat people, other actors, you know, the directors?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of a two-parter. Yeah, I think it's very challenging. You know, it's interesting. In my youth, I don't think I had enough of an appreciation for that. Because it's that idea of, you know, you're trying to build a career, you're trying to get your foot in the door, and you're trying to make way for yourself. But over time, I've certainly learned that. You know, I've had enduring friendships like Downey. We're developing a project called Singularity, a TV project with he and his wife, Susan, who's wonderful, at their company, which is called Team Downey. And that's, I'll be honest with you, Mike, it's been something we've been working on for 5-6 years, and we haven't brought it to fruition yet. But in terms of friendships and relationships, absolutely. You know, I have a lot of the core guys that I grew up with. They're still my great friends. But I think what I had to unlearn is kind of drawing a line, like, okay, show business friends versus, you know what I mean? So I look at it with, again, hopefully a sense of humility, and I try to just enjoy the people I'm working with. But there's also a bittersweet aspect to it, too. Like, I'm sure that there's guys that you've served with that, you know, you'll serve with and you'll finish a mission, then you might not see them for 10 years, or it might be 20 years, you know. But I think that working with that awareness and that humility of knowing your role, knowing your thing, but at the same time, having an appreciation for everybody's involvement and everybody's contribution. That's something that this industry has taught me, and I'm grateful for it, because again, you're always working in teams. You know, it's never just, no man is an island, as the saying goes, you know, so that's very valuable. And so as I get older, I realize, look, I could have been better friend, you know, and I think I can enjoy more friendships, and I should still seek out friendships. I think there's a thing for us as guys that maybe we kind of shut down a little bit and we go, oh, okay, no more friends, or I've had enough, or, you know, I know who I know. And I think it's important to have an open heart and stay open to new friendships and new opportunities. You know?
Well, you know, I can't thank you enough for coming on again, to have somebody on who was, you got to say, for what it is, Hollywood is formative on our lives from what we watch. And I mean, growing up, you were formative on us. Where can people follow you beyond social media? Can they go to Manhattan Films? Is it manhattanfilms.com? What can they follow your work and what you're
doing? Thank you, Mike. Yeah, first of all, I want to say thank you for the opportunity. It's an honor to speak with you, and I appreciate the time. Thank you, Mike. Yeah, I mean, I'm on Instagram at AMH4 and then Real. I do have a website for my company, manhattan.film, and manhattanfilms.com. So we have that as well. And yeah, you know, I'm just looking forward. You know, I'm always kind of pushing forward. I'm not someone who's too retrospective. I'm looking forward to what's ahead. So thank God. You know, I just thank God for the opportunities and the life that he's given me. I'm grateful.
Yeah. Well, sir, thank you for your time. And for everyone else, this has been another episode of the Everyday Warrior Podcast. We'll see you next time.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.